share the airwaves with African High Life, Afrobeat, Congolese soukous, Malian blues, juju, and South African kwaito, among the other great styles. Traditional and modern expressions are all included. On alternate weeks, check out Top Rankin Reggae and Dancehall with Shocks of Sheba show, hosted by Teresa and Michelle. Any week, Thursdays at noon is sure to move ya.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Laurelhurst Theater and Pub, independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent, and classic films, microbrews, pizza, salads, and wraps. Located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland, 503-232-5511 or laurelhursttheater.com.
I told her no, baby, you know I don't wanna go.
Hello and welcome to Words and Pictures on KBOO. I'm your host, S.W. Kauncer, and we are delighted to welcome back into the studio Joe Sacco, the graphic novelist, cartoonist, globetrotter, and the author of the new, well, it's not so much a book, it's almost an accordion fold piece of art. It's called The Great War, July 1st, 1916, the first day of the Battle of the Somme, an illustrated panorama. Joe Sacco, welcome back to KBOO.
It's good to be here, as always.
I'm looking at this book right now, and it has no hinge. It has a front and a back hardcover. And when you pull it out, it's an accordion fold. And it might be compared to the way that Jack Kerouac wrote On the Road. Supposedly, he wrote it on one continuous roll of paper.
Is that right? That's interesting.
How wide is this book when it's completely laid out end to end?
Yeah, when it's laid out, it's about 23 or 24 feet.
Wow. You've compared it to the Bayeux Tapestry.
Well, let me just say comparing it to the Bayeux Tapestry because that's a masterpiece, of course. But that's what gave me the idea to approach this drawing in this way. There's an editor at Norton who called me up, and we were roommates in New York City a long time ago. And once, a long time ago, we had this discussion about an accordion fold-out drawing of the First World War, which I promptly forgot. But then he reminded me of, you know, about a year or two ago. And when we discussed it, I realized I didn't want to draw a static image. And what came to my mind was the Bayeux Tapestry. It was sort of an inspiration, this idea that in the West, you know, you read from left to right. And if you have a long image, that's basically how you're going to read it, too, is from left to right.
And the Bayeux Tapestry itself is over 200 feet. It's actually an embroidered icon that hung for a while in the cathedral, not so far from the Somme, actually just west of the Somme in the town of Bayeux in France. And it goes back to the Norman Conquest in the 11th century, the French conquest over England depicting William the Conqueror. And as you said, it runs left to right and is this epic account of the Battle of Hastings. And in this case, you start out at the left and you go through day and night and day again. In some ways, it's almost a 360-degree view of the battlefield and the area behind the battlefield, the supply lines, the horse-drawn ambulances, the railway, and thousands of soldiers are depicted.
Right. Well, I wanted to show something of the enormous human endeavor that is war. You know, when you think about the species, you think about you think about human nature and what we're about. And some say we're a cooperative species, and there's obviously evidence for that. That might be one of the reasons we've succeeded, if you want to talk about it in biological terms, to dominate the planet. But cooperation can be to destroy other people who are cooperating, which is the case in war. And you know, I had to reread a lot of books and look at some more material when I was looking to draw this thing. And I think that's what really impressed me quite a bit, is the enormous energy, human energy, to get the war cranked up to this level. And then it all ends up in a fiasco. And that's what when you read this long...
This day that you're depicting was a hinge point. I mean, the British were expecting this decisive victory, and instead it just blew up completely.
Right. Well, the British soldiers, many of whom had never being in a battle, a lot of them were told that the Germans opposing them would be wiped out because there was an unprecedented artillery bombardment that went on for 7 days and nights. And it amazed anyone that soldiers could survive this kind of bombardment. But the Germans had dug very deeply into the ground with their dugouts. I mean, a lot of people were killed, obviously, in the bombardment, but there were enough troops that still had the presence of mind to hold off the British. Some of the British soldiers were told they'd find no living German in the trenches. And because it was a lot of untrained troops, they were told to line up and basically walk across no man's land. They were told to walk at 1 yard intervals in a line. So you can see, I mean, with all that, about half the British troops that went over the top, probably more than half, were actually casualties by the end of the day.
I think this book is going to find a really broad audience among military historians, the folks who love these really precise depictions of infantry, of military hardware, of the scenes of battle, and you've depicted them with an incredible eye for detail, and in some cases, an incredible amount of beauty. I'm looking at these explosions that are taking place in the battlefield, these mines and these artillery fires, and they're almost like Japanese depictions of clouds, watercolors of chrysanthemum blossoms, that sort of thing. Are you worried you might be getting across the wrong message sometimes?
Well, I certainly wouldn't want to get across the message that it's beautiful. They're stylized. I sort of stylized them. I mean, I compressed them. I gave the whole thing a medieval look. I wasn't just influenced by the Bayeux Tapestry, but medieval art in general, because nothing is really to proportion. Nothing is really to scale. If I had to draw this to scale, the book would go on for hundreds of feet. And I've drawn it so that, you know, a few miles can be depicted in 12 inches.
Well, in the book, you say that you had some very fortunate encounters when you're visiting London in being able to access records at the Imperial War Museum, and also a number of scholars loaned you their personal collections of material.
Well, there was one historian named Julian Petkowski. I was trying to find a scholar or a historian through the Imperial War Museum that would be willing to sit down and talk to me about it, because I wanted to make sure I had the certain things right, certain details right, and I was confused about certain issues and how to draw them. And on the spur of the moment, and just by some coincidence, I found Julian Petkowski, who has written a lot about British soldiers shot for deserting. And he was very generous. I mean, he gave me some field books from 1914 to take with me that would show me certain things. I mean, these field books were very precise in how things were done for the British Army. So at least I could use those as a sort of a starting point for understanding certain very specific details. But we sat down for about 2 hours and we went over certain things, like how exactly did they go over the top? You know, when soldiers are approaching the ladders, how is that working? And he would explain, well, you'd have a sergeant or someone like that making sure that one guy went up one side and one guy went up the other side. I mean, all these little things that you can convert into drawing that may not matter to most people, but I think that journalist in me wants to get details right. You know, that's why I spent a lot of time, as much time as I could, at the photo archives at the Imperial War Museum. They have binders on certain things, binders on how is water carried up to the front. I had no idea. But these binders had, you know, photographed after photograph, and basically what I did is spent 3 or 4 days just photocopying image after image after image, knowing that, you know, I would need this stuff. And just looking at those photographs gave me ideas of things I didn't really know before. Because as many books as I've seen about the First World War, including photography books, they normally don't get into, you know, how did soldiers get their water? How did they carry their stew to the front line? That's not the kind of thing you see in most even image-heavy books of the First World War.
Well, when you were in the studio before, a couple of years ago, you talked about going into Palestine, going into the Gaza Strip, and you had a leg up in some ways over many other journalists from the West in that you were able to show your previous books about Palestine and people understood who you were because there wasn't a language barrier. There were these artistic depictions of people they recognized, of places that they recognized. So all of a sudden, you were very welcome. You were much more free to talk with these folks and have effective interactions for your book, Footnotes in Gaza. I'm thinking that The Great War, this illustrated panorama, this is almost the purest distillation of what a cartoonist does. You're depicting something without a single word and allowing people to really draw their own conclusions based simply on the imagery.
Yeah, that's right. I wanted to do something like this, and I've needed to do something different creatively. This gave me an opportunity to just stretch out with the drawing, to really just allow myself to draw and not to think of the words. And what was interesting about the actual process was it just gave me time to reflect, and I could really sink into the drawing. I wasn't changing the images from one panel to another. I mean, doing comics also has its own, as an artist, it's got its fun, let's say. But doing something like this, I can't say it was all fun because it's hard to depict some of that stuff that's violent. But it just gave me time to stretch out and to think only of drawing. And I've never thought of myself as a particularly good drawer. In a way, relatively good at composition, but not technically good. But if you're drawing thousands of people and hundreds of vehicles, you end up learning something and you get better. So, I mean, on that level, it was just kind of a good thing for me. It was a good exercise, among other things.
So even when you're called upon to illustrate books here in the U.S., such as your recent collaboration with Chris Hedges, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, you know, even in this case, you're called upon to depict some very harsh realities. Like you said, you're kind of champing at the bit to get back to something fun again.
Well, when I say fun, I mean, I think my work is always going to have a political and a satirical edge to it, where I'm commenting about what's going on. So when I say fun, that's a relative term. My work is, I hope, will always look at the way the world really is. I just need to do it in a different way. I'll still do journalism, but I want to do something other than journalism. I want to sort of look at some of the same topics, but more artistically, as a fiction writer would, for example. I'm not sure if I'll do fiction, but I need, just for myself, to freshen up my creative life.
You don't want your older years to be spent thinking back on your glory days of globetrotting.
No, my inspiration is kind of Miles Davis, because you look at his career and you realize he pretty much changed directions three times or four times, and each time he was at the forefront of that direction. And that's a real inspiration to me, because he would basically decide that, okay, he's done this and now he needs to go in another direction, which might be risky artistically. You might not even know what you're doing and you might end up doing inferior work, but he's an inspiration because he never did. He always did something interesting as far as I'm concerned.
Well, maybe we should play some Miles Davis right now.
Miles would be great.
Listening to Words and Pictures on KBOO. I'm your host, S.W. Konser, and we're here in the studio with Joe Sacco, whose latest book, it's actually an illustrated panorama. It's called The Great War, and it depicts July 1st, 1916, the first day of the Battle of the Somme. You've been deeply affected by war yourself. You've been in so many trouble spots around the world. You've been famous for your books Palestine, Footnotes in Gaza, Safe Area at Garajda. So tell me about this project. What fascinates you so much about World War I, and particularly this date that this book hinges on, July 1st, 1916?
Well, I've been fascinated in the First World War since I was a kid. I grew up in Australia. And in Australia, the First World War really figures to a great degree in their national consciousness, particularly the landings at Gallipoli in 1915. They commemorate the day of the landings, Anzac Day, it's called, on April 25th. And I remember as a kid in school, they would stop class and they would broadcast over the wireless stories about the First World War. And I remember watching TV and seeing veterans of the First World War, you know, marching down the streets of Melbourne. And I got a book when I was a kid, too, about the First World War that just kind of interested me, because what boy of a certain age is not just appalled and fascinated by gas masks, trenches, barbed wire, strange-looking tanks, biplane aircraft, all that sort of stuff that is a little boy that sort of pulls you in but appalls you, too. I mean, even at a young age, I was kind of appalled by what I was learning about the war, you know, this idea of trench warfare, where huge armies basically fought each other over hundreds of yards, and sometimes barely any territory was gained or lost in a major battle that ate up hundreds of thousands of lives. And that's the case with the Battle of the Somme. The Battle of the Somme went on for about 5 or 6 months, from July to November of 1916, and on the first day, the British Army, the very first day, they suffered 60,000 casualties, of which about 21,000 were deaths. You know, people who died outright or died of their wounds. And to put that in perspective, you know, the entire number of dead from American dead from the Iraq War and the Afghanistan War was less than probably were killed in the first hour, because the estimates at the Somme are that 10,000 were killed. British soldiers were killed in the first hour.
Now, you point out in your notes to the Great War that the majority of the young soldiers coming to the front on July 1st had never seen battle before, and many of them had these visions of gallantry that had been thrummed into their head by the British school system, and instead what they walked into was a sort of mechanized carnage.
No, that's exactly right. But you could say that about every country's army. You know, even the Americans went to war in 1917 and basically were in the field in 1918 in France, and they also had a great enthusiasm. When you read about the First World War, you realize it was almost as if, for young men, it was like a dream come true, this great adventure. And with the Battle of the Somme, most of the British soldiers were from a volunteer army. Before that, there'd been a professional army that was basically very badly bloodied in 1914, a reserve army that was very badly bloodied in 1915, and so this was a volunteer army. And people signed up with their friends. There were PALS battalions. And there was just this great enthusiasm. Whole classes signed up en masse. There were units for artists. You know, it was just, there was just upswelling of support and enthusiasm, even though the early battles of the war had already been very bloody. And on the first day, and then subsequently in 1916 through the Battle of the Somme, a lot of the volunteer army was just chewed up too. And then conscription was introduced.
Well, certainly not a conflict that you were party to.
No, but you know, it's funny because I've read so many books about the First World War, and you realize when you read a lot of books, it's like you feel like if you have any organic connection with people in the past, and I often do, anytime I'm reading a good history book, I feel like those people are real that I'm reading about. They sort of matter to me. They're part of the human story. They're not dead and gone when I'm reading the book. You know, it's like reading Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five. All these things are parallel and going on at the same time. To me, World War I went on, so it's always going on. you know, as long as I'm reading those books and reading about those things, those people are very much alive to me. So it's not such a stretch for me to think of going back into the past. And yes, I have nothing to do with that war in a literal sense, except I've read so much about it that in some ways it courses through my veins too. And this is a way of sort of taking that voyeuristic notion of reading a lot of books about one subject sort of obsessively and distilling it and finding something artistic to actually say about it. So I feel like I'm redeeming myself for spending so much time thinking about it and reading about it.
Now, when you read the history books that they hand out at school, you see that the powder keg for World War I was considered the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand in Sarajevo. And you have a lot of familiarity with Sarajevo, having been in the Balkans during the 90s, during the Balkan Wars, around Serbia, around the former Yugoslavia. And I'm wondering, at that point even, there was still some collective cultural memory of the end of the Ottoman Empire and of all of the bad blood that came in around the time of World War I.
And actually the Ottoman Empire hadn't completely crumbled. It crumbled after World War I. It was one of the empires that was sort of swept away by the First World War. Actually, I was in Sarajevo this last summer, and I visited the museum that is that they have there that's devoted to the assassination. When you look at the specifics of the First World War, it's pretty interesting because there was the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which included many, many different nationalities. Among them was a minority Serb population in Bosnia. And that was, I mean, there was nationalism was also an important aspect of that particular time and place. And, you know, you had a Serb nationalist, an ultra-nationalist, killing the Archduke. And this began sort of a whole series of steps that led to the war that, you know, depending on what history book you read, you get sort of different stories about what could have been done or whether it was inevitable. But even the Austrians had plans already before this happened to maybe teach the Serbia a lesson. So in some ways, you could say the assassination was a convenient thing for the militarists to grasp onto and to sort of set some a chain of events in motion. And then, of course, it took such a long time to mobilize troops that once troops were mobilized, it was very hard to demobilize them. And if you saw a neighboring country mobilizing its troops, you mobilize too, because it would just take a long time. And then it's very difficult to call back, in some cases, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of troops. And this inevitability, you know, sometimes you read books and they'll talk about the inevitability of once it started, once things got into motion.
The general that you portray here, General Haig, he's reluctant to pull back these British troops that are being massacred, tens of thousands of troops being massacred. And his reluctance is based on this sort of old-fashioned sense of warfare, this gallantry, and this idea that anybody who retreats might be called a coward.
As far as General Haig goes, you can read books that really tear him apart. And I sort of agree with those books, but also I'm not sure if any military strategist knew exactly how to crack the nut of trench warfare at that time. You know, he initiated the battle, and I think not just him, but the British High Command would have a hard time saying we've lost so many soldiers and we're just going to wind down the offensive immediately. Basically, they made a few gains, and the idea was you just keep feeding troops into it. I think for the people in the High Command, they basically decided that you can't sort of admit that you've blundered, and you keep thinking if you keep knocking at this door, it's eventually going to come down. And someone like Haig, I mean, you talked about gallantry. Well, what's interesting about him is he was a cavalry officer. The two British field marshals in World War I, the two commanders that the British had in World War I, were both cavalrymen. And his idea was you would knock a hole in the German lines and the cavalry would go through, and suddenly it would become a war of movement again. But no matter what evidence was sort of in their face that the machine age was now upon us and machine guns were just wiping out waves of troops, they still thought, someone like Haig still thought that the cavalry could be key, which shows how wrong someone like that could be. And what's also slightly interesting about this too is that the tank was first introduced at the Battle of the Somme. Toward the end of the Battle of the Somme, the British employed a few tanks that they just developed, which ended up replacing the cavalry.
I don't know about you, but I've been noticing narrative threads creeping into our popular culture nowadays about the end of empire. I've heard so many citations in the last couple of years of Percy Bysshe Shelley's Ozymandias, you know, that image of the head of the great imperial king moldering away in the desert. That seems to be catching a lot of the imagination these days at what's possibly the waning days of our empire.
Well, waning or not, I'm not so sure. I mean, at least in a military sense, it's still a major empire. It's flailing. Does that mean it's got any competition yet? I mean, well, it's still playing out in a way. But as far as the poem you're referencing, I was at the Louvre a few times over the last year and a half looking at their Near Eastern collection. And very literally, there are statues that are headless, even though there are curses written on the statues for anyone who would damage it. It's, you know, a leader. Let's say in this particular case, it's Gudea, who was the city ruler of a town called Lagash. And his statues sometimes have curses on the written on them in cuneiform saying, whoever damages this statue, you know, there's a curse on you, that sort of thing. And what's interesting, a lot of them have been decapitated, perhaps in some war or whatever. And there are tourists who are leaning up against them, putting their heads where the head of the statue should be to get their friends to take photographs. There's a real good example of where, you know, rulers end up. Historically, you know, you might be the most grand and illustrious and give it a few centuries, and who's going to remember or who's going to take you seriously?
So any other interesting projects that you're really eyeing? Do you have anything specific in mind, or are you going to kind of go the Zen route? Are you just going to let something come in and take a hold of you and show you where to go?
Well, I've got very specific things that I'm working on. I'm working on a satire. I'm working on a book or some sort of project, let's say that has to do with Mesopotamia, ancient Mesopotamia.
Oh, really?
Yeah, where I've been interviewing archaeologists over the last year and a half. I mean, little by little, over time, whenever I'm in a city and I know some archaeologist, you know, lives there, I'll get a hold of him or her and speak to them about it.
Like Gilgamesh era or something?
Yeah, even before Gilgamesh era. So little by little, I've accrued some interviews about that, and I've been reading a hell of a lot about it too. So I'm not exactly sure how I'm going to approach it as far as a comic goes, but that's where I want to go. I'm interested in human society, how it all started, how hierarchy developed, how social inequality developed. Again, I'm not trying to do it journalistically necessarily, but I'm using some of those journalistic skills like interviewing to learn something from people who really are the experts.
It's always great to have you in the studio, Joe Sacco. The book is The Great War, July 1st, 1916, the first day of the Battle of the Somme. It's an illustrated panorama, and it's also accompanied by an author's note. It's a small book with a little excerpt from Adam Hochschild, one of the great historians.
Oh, I really admire Adam Hochschild's work quite a bit. I mean, King Leopold's Ghost, that was as much as a page-turner as any book could be. He's a great researcher, but he really has a facility with the word. That's how history should be written. Sometimes I look at that, and it's a different medium, but I sort of aspire to that. You know, his work is great.
And this is all included in the author's note. So the book is out from Norton. Joe Sacco, always a pleasure to have you in the studio. Please come back again whenever you like.
Okay, thanks a lot. It was always a pleasure to be at KBOO.
You've been listening to Words and Pictures on KBOO. I'm your host, S.W. Konser. Thanks to all our listeners at 90.7 FM and on the web, An expanded version of the show will be available later at kboo.fm, Words and Pictures. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at Words and Picture. Now stay tuned for an afternoon of music on your homegrown Portland radio station.
He promised he would write to me. That promise he's kept true.
It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Thursday, November 14th. I'm Kristen Yount. Authorities rescued 386 children after a sting on child pornography. Children were discovered in many locations around the world. Project Spade originated in Canada, stemming from authorities investigating a man who allegedly paid people to make the films with adolescents and then distributed them through his website. The subsequent raid gave authorities scads of digital information to sort through. 348 arrests were made for creating, distributing, and purchasing obscene material. The man made millions of dollars a year from selling the terrible material. Arrests were made in Canada, the United States, Europe, and Asia. Snapchat, the phone application that allows users to take photos, augment them with touchpad scribbles, and send them to other Snapchat users, could fetch a cool $3 billion from social media giant Facebook. The 20-person company out of Venice, California, rejected the offer. The offer seems strange to industry insiders because Snapchat doesn't generate revenue. Also, the allure of Snapchat is that whatever you send to a select friend or two, it automatically disappears into the ether seconds after it's sent. Unlike Facebook, there isn't a data trail leading back to the moment you sent the photo to incriminate you later. Insiders say that aligning Facebook with Snapchat would ruin the fun. Sectarian violence continues in war-torn Iraq. In total, 47 people were murdered yesterday, and many more were injured as the Shiite